I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media, we're going to continue our ongoing community conversation about Indiana's and America's opioid epidemic. We're going to discuss the availability of the overdose treatment drug naloxone. My guests are Dr. John Agley with the Indiana Prevention Resource Center, Justin Phillips of Overdose Lifeline, and Kelly Williams, clinical pharmacy specialist with Eskenazi Health. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits at WFYI.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today, and this is part of our ongoing community conversation about Indiana's and America's opioid epidemic. We're going to be talking about the availability of the overdose treatment drug naloxone. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. John Agley. He is with the Indiana Prevention Resource Center, Justin Phillips of Overdose Lifeline, and Kelly Williams, a clinical pharmacy specialist with Eskenazi Health. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. So first, we probably ought to talk about what this drug is. And I'll start with Justin on that one and what it does.
Yes, absolutely. Naloxone, otherwise known as Narcan, is an overdose reversal drug.
So I mispronounced it.
It's okay. It happens all the
time.
Well,
I do know Narcan. But,
yes.
Yeah.
It's the overdose reversal drug. So essentially, if you have an opioid in your system, the drug naloxone will kick the opioid off the receptors in your brain and reverse the overdose. If there's no opioids, it's an absolutely harmless drug.
Okay. So it sounds like, in that brief description, that it's a no-brainer. But there are issues surrounding its availability right now. Kelly, could you talk a little bit about what some of those issues are?
I think some of the issues around its availability is public awareness, mm-hmm. not knowing exactly what pharmacy has it. I know at Eskenazi Health, all 10 of our pharmacies have it on stock. And then it's also, where can you get it? How much does it cost? Am I going to be judged if I walk up to the pharmacy counter and ask for it? Is it going to be billed through my insurance? Is it going to be covered? How much does it cost? Things like that. There's a lot of stigma, and I think it's important that I'm glad we're having this topic. The stigma associated with naloxone, automatically, I think when people talk about it, they think that I'm an addict, or if I'm walking up to the pharmacy counter to ask for it, then I must be someone that's going to overdose. And I think it's important for us to talk about how this medication is a life-saving medication. I kind of equate it to diabetes. When someone is, on insulin for the first time, we talk about what low blood sugar looks like. And, mm-hmm. If you have low blood sugar, you drink juice, eat hard candy or something like that. It's the same thing with naloxone. If someone's taking an opioid, it's really good to have this medication on hand because you don't know what that fatal dose may be.
How many people are we talking about here, Dr. Agley, who would benefit from using naloxone?
Nationally, our drug overdose deaths in the U.S. tripled from 1999 to 2014. 2014, there were 47,000-some drug overdose deaths, and more than 60% of those involved in opioid. So in those cases, plus obviously there are opioid deaths that were averted via naloxone or other means. Mm-hmm. In all those cases, this is a preventive measure that could be effective, because as Justin said, it's naloxone is very effective as an opioid antagonist of kind of bouncing the opioid off of that receptor, and so it really rapidly reverses and blocks the effect of opioids in the short term, which is why it kind of looks like a miracle drug sometimes when you administer it.
Are there side effects associated with it? I'll stay with Dr. Agley, but I see Justin also wants to get in on the discussion.
Well, the short answer is kind of. And I know that's not very specific, because what happens is when you reverse and block the effects of opioids, what you may, but not always, but sometimes, go into, have an individual go into withdrawal, as they would, you know, with longer-term reduction of opioid in the system. And that can be uncomfortable. It's rarely life-threatening. And it's, if you're looking at a cost-benefit analysis, it always falls on the side of the naloxone administration in a case where someone has overdosed.
Kelly, mm-hmm. Justin pointed at you, so I'm assuming she wants you to answer this.
She's the pharmacist.
One. Okay. Are there side effects, things that people should be aware of when they use naloxone?
And again, I agree with Dr. Agley. The short answer is no, but you know, with all medications, there are some side effects, but I think the biggest thing is to remember that this person was near death. And so, you know, even if it does cause a little bit of hypertension, or if you use the nasal spray, inflammation of the nasal passages, that's okay. You know, you just save their lives.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So let me ask this. Do you have to be on the edge of overdose to use this? Or is it, can it be used for in other circumstances as well? I'll start with Justin, in part because you are with the Overdose Lifeline.
Sure. So I think it's important to understand that respiratory distress is the number one side effect of an opioid. Mm-hmm. And individuals who are heavily medicated will often have difficulty responding appropriately. So, for example, someone who I'm aware of who had a knee replacement surgery, mm-hmm. and was over-medicated in the hospital was having difficulty responding appropriately to the physical therapy. So they provided him with naloxone to counteract what that is just an overdosing of the medication. Mm-hmm. So again, individuals now currently in this public health crisis are overdosing at a pretty significant rate. Current statistics are telling us someone is dying every 12 and a half minutes, somewhere around 174 people a day. The challenge is...
Nationally, not here in the
Yes,
state.
Nationally. The challenge is, if someone is misusing their opioid, either in a prescription form or intravenous form, they're not really aware that they're overdosing. And the challenge becomes really that someone else in the immediate environment needs to be aware that it's a possibility and have naloxone readily available. And that could be an individual who's legitimately taking a prescription. Mm-hmm. They could be overdosing, no different than the individual who is misusing.
Correct.
The importance is to have naloxone available and to not be using in whatever form or fashion alone.
We are talking, if you're just joining us, we are talking today on No Limits about the availability of the overdose treatment drug naloxone. It is a response of sorts to Indiana's and America's opioid epidemic. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Dr. Agley, you know, it sounds like obviously if you are either in the midst of or on the verge of an opioid overdose, and you're in the care of trained medical professionals, they would know pretty quickly to use naloxone. What are some of the signs, though, that other people who are around you or you yourself should take note of, and is it possible for it to be self-administered? I'll start with Dr. Agley on that, but I see everybody nodding ahead, so I think you all want to answer part of this. Mm-hmm. Dr. Agley?
It's a deceptively complex question, and the first thing I'll say is, as I'm not a clinician by specialty, I'll defer the specific answer to the pharmacist on the call. That having been said, I will say there are excellent resources available online. that list the typical signs of an overdose. I mean, some of them Justin actually mentioned a little earlier. Those references are very useful for laypersons who are administering naloxone, but something to bear in mind is that if you're involved in getting access to a naloxone distribution kit or something like that, there also is a training that is associated with that that would teach those recognition skills. But that having been said, I'll defer to the pharmacological expert on the call.
Okay. Yeah, Kelly, it sounds like that's you.
Yeah, that's me. Dr. Agley is correct in regards to whenever a person does receive this kit in the pharmacy, there's an extensive training that we give about when to use it, how to use it, recognizing the signs and symptoms, and how to administer it. So some of the signs and symptoms, or how do you know when, you know, someone should receive it, is the biggest thing is unusual sleepiness, or groggy or slurred speech. They just kind of seem out of it. Very difficult to awake. So you can be yelling their name or do the chest rub on their chest bone and they're not responding to you. The breaths, the shallow breaths, shallow breathing. It can be some snoring or maybe gurgling sounds. Pinpoint pupils. So when you pull their eyelid back, you can look at the colored part of their eye to see if it's pinpoint. So that's another sign that this person may be overdosing. Clammy or cool skin, or the body may be limp as well.
Okay. Justin, do you have anything you want to add?
I think you asked the question, and everyone has already given a lot of great information. Can you self-administer? And I think it's pretty challenging because, mm-hmm. again, individuals often are not aware that they're overdosing and that they're actually going to go into full respiratory arrest.
Yeah.
Because the nodding off, as Kelly prescribed, is part of the use, which is why we know we have so many people overdosing in so many public places. And when we do our training at Overdose Lifeline, we will tell the public individuals we're training, if you see people unusually falling asleep mm-hmm. inappropriately, that is an overdose.
Mm-hmm. So, but I would think this is part of the challenge also of getting our hands on this epidemic and even administering this treatment, because it's not like people say, well, I want to schedule my overdose for next Wednesday at 3
right.
o'clock.
Right.
Can you get me into the doctor then?
Right.
Just like they don't schedule heart attacks or other health problems.
Right.
At some level, they have to be able to self-diagnose or self-administer, or at least the people who are around them need to be able to recognize the signs. I mean, how much of that adds to the challenge? I'll start with Justin on that, but I want to hear Kelly's thoughts as well.
Well, exactly correct. No one's scheduling their overdose nor believing that they will overdose. And I think this is one of the points that Surgeon General Adams made back in April, that we all should have naloxone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That if you are prescribed an opioid, you should also be prescribed naloxone. It should be part of the way we have, you know, we used to have Ipecac syrup because of poisoning in our homes and things like that, which is what we do at Overdose Lifeline. We repeatedly remind individuals, if you choose to use or misuse, please don't do it alone and please carry naloxone.
Is that part of the message then? And it sounds like it. You can overdose even if you're not misusing it, some people have different tolerances
yeah.
and all of that. Should this be something that we just do as a matter of course, that if you've got opioids, you should have naloxone?
Absolutely.
Kelly?
Absolutely. And I think that in different states, they are saying if there's a certain quantity of opioids that are being prescribed at the pharmacy counter, you need to also say, hey, here's naloxone as well for you to purchase. This is why I think it's good for you. Along those lines of the administration, it's important that, you know, if someone is necessarily not misusing, but taking it like prescribed, but are they also a heavy drinker?
Mm-hmm.
Do they use benzos mm-hmm. such as Xanax or Valium or, you know, sleeping medications like Ambien? All that together combined can also precipitate an overdose that's unintended.
If you are just joining, did you want to add
I was just going to say also changes in metabolism mm-hmm. with elderly patients can mm-hmm. often trigger a different response to the regular medication they've been taking.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot to talk about here, I can tell. And it's a good thing we've got another 40 minutes to do it. We are talking today on No Limits about the overdose treatment drug naloxone. This is part of our ongoing partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. John Agley with the Indiana Prevention Resource Center, Justin Phillips of Overdose Lifeline, and Kelly Williams, clinical pharmacy specialist with Eskenazi Health. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the availability of the overdose treatment drug naloxone. This is a program as part of our ongoing partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media. My guests are Dr. John Agley with the Indiana Prevention Resource Center, Justin Phillips of Overdose Lifeline, and Kelly Williams, clinical pharmacy specialist with Eskenazi Health. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Ben has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ben, you're on the air.
Thank you, and thanks so much for talking about this subject. It's really important. This might be kind of a dumb question, but I was wondering, I don't have any friends or family at least that I know of, that are prescribed or abuse opioids. But I'm wondering if it is still, I guess, advisable for somebody who is like myself, who's just concerned about the opioid epidemic, to try to get their hands on some naloxone to have on hand, or if that's just kind of unnecessary, absurd overkill, I guess. And then also, is there at any point in the overdose process where naloxone is no longer effective, or is it always if you have it and you see somebody, even if it's, you know, they're really close to death, give it, it might work? Thanks so much. I'll take my answer up.
Thanks very much for the call and the questions, Ben. Kelly.
So, yes, I would advise you to go ahead and get it. I mean, you never know when a friend may need it. Again, with the overdose, you don't know what it is that person took. You don't know if it's heroin or pain pills or if that person is suffering from something else. And as we alluded to earlier, nothing's going to happen if opioids are not in the system. This drug is not going to hurt that person one way or the other. And I just think that it's good to have on hand.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, though, Dr. Agley, it's not something you can just walk up to the pharmacy and get, though. You need a prescription, right? Dr. Agley? No?
No.
No, you don't need a prescription.
Anymore?
No, because of Aaron's law.
Yep, that was once the case, but it is no longer the case.
Okay.
And that's I believe, as of last year, 50 of 51 states, including Indiana, had some form of mechanism that lets individuals obtain it without a prescription. And in Indiana, for example, we talked about get that naloxone distribution kit, which is done through a standing order. But along with that, it's typically recommended to actually, if you don't have training, get CPR training as well, because typically the state recommends in their documentation through the opt-in program that you administer naloxone, and then if there's still no pulse and you're trained in CPR, that you would administer CPR. So this is something that anyone who goes through the appropriate processes can obtain.
Mm-hmm. So, Justin, I'll reframe the question then. If you can just walk up and get it, if you don't have a prescription or a healthcare professional doesn't recommend it, then will your insurance cover it, or are you paying out of pocket?
So insurance covers it. Mm-hmm.
And even if the doctor doesn't say you need it?
Correct, because we have a statewide standing order. So in 2015, then Governor Pence signed what is called Aaron's Law, which is named after my son, who I lost in 2013 to a heroin overdose.
I'm sorry.
And that's okay. And that's one of the reasons Overdose Lifeline started, was to create better access to the overdose reversal drug naloxone. So we have a statewide standing order now that allows you to go into any pharmacy without a prescription and request naloxone. That pharmacy should file insurance for you, and or you may have to pay out of pocket. You can also access naloxone at some of the local health departments, and you can also access naloxone through Overdose Lifeline. We provide kits still free to families and caregivers because we realize, as Kelly alluded to earlier, there's a lot of stigma and barrier to walking into a pharmacy and asking for the drug.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to talk about that. I want to get to the cost question real quickly, Kelly, because if there are people out there who are curious about this, if I walk in and say I want this, and we'll deal with the whole stigma question, but if they're willing to walk past that, basically, mm-hmm. and say I want to do this, what can they expect to be charged?
So, again, at Eskenazi Health, our improvised kits are about $80. But, however, there are programs in place that will help you afford that medication, whether it be free or at a specific discounted rate. If you walk into other retail stores, some of the big CVS, your Walgreens, Walmart, things like that, it may be closer to $140, but this is going to be the commercially available nasal spray.
Okay.
So it is.
And we probably ought to talk about that, too, that there are several ways to get and administer naloxone, too, that the nasal spray. But that, is that the most common means, or do they do it in other ways?
The most common is the nasal spray. If you do the Evzio, it kind of tells you how to give the injection and things like that. That's upward $5,000. So the nasal spray is the most common.
Okay. We have a question from a listener who did not want to go on the line and wanted to remain unknown. Says, can the guest talk about the psych behind addiction? He was curious about how people's beliefs collide with reality. Justin, I'll start with you on that one.
That's an interesting question, and I hope that I understand your question, listener. You know, addiction is a chronic brain disease, and what happens in our brains after we introduce substances is changes occur, and some individuals are more prone to susceptibility than others, but we all are prone to the changes in the brain occurring. And over time, the drug hijacks the system so that an individual seeks the drug above everything else in order to receive what some may refer to as the reward that comes from the dopamine or the glutamate that's released from the drug itself. It's very illogical and hard to understand when someone you love will steal from you even though you know they don't want to hurt you, and it's always the drug. I'm not sure I understand the second part of the question.
Well, I think it is, I'm guessing, and the caller can call back if we get this wrong, and we'll take another crack at it. Mm-hmm. I think what they're talking about is whether we just try to ignore things that we don't want to see.
There are signs. Yes, we do. We absolutely do. I mean, I will say publicly often that the shame and the stigma and the denial played a huge role in the outcome for Aaron. And I don't say that to be guilty. I just say that it's a complex problem. And we are in a public health crisis that we are not acknowledging the way that we would if it were some other chronic disease, mm-hmm. because we don't really know what to do. Mm. It's almost easier just to act as if nothing's happening.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Colleen, and if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Colleen writes, "Hello, I worked in a retail pharmacy setting for 2 years, and since naloxone has become available for over-the-counter purchase using a standing order, no one has bought it at my store on the south side of Indianapolis. However, we have plenty of people coming to buy needles over-the-counter for," this is in open quotes, "for their grandmother's insulin," close quotes. "There is still a negative stigma attached to purchasing naloxone, even if you are purchasing it because your loved one is in active addiction. The price also can be prohibitive, though the cash price for the nasal spray is about $35. For someone on a low or fixed income. $35 is groceries or a few meals. I personally believe that naloxone should be available in medical response kits in businesses and schools, as it is not only those using illegal drugs who overdose. Many people who suffer injuries or chronic pain still have to maintain a job, and it is possible, especially for the elderly population, to experience overdose even though a person has been using prescribed opioids long term. So it seems to me that tees up at least part of the stigma question we're talking about. The resistance here is cultural rather than medical. There's no shortage of the drug, I presume,
no,
or anything like that. It is that the people who need it often will not go in and ask for it. I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts on how we get past that. I'll start with Dr. Agley on that one.
You know, this is an issue without easy answers, mm-hmm. and it seems like for many public health issues related to addiction and other pharmacological and medical issues that begin with a behavior, we encounter stigma both on the part of the provider sometimes and on the part of the individual seeking help. And the basic premise is that if an individual goes and asks for naloxone at a pharmacy, what will people think? What will the pharmacist say? Are there legal repercussions? All of these things are things that we might take for granted as public health professionals as understood, but that, you know, the average person who doesn't do this specific thing day to day may not have answers for those things. And so I think stigma reduction campaigns, media education, and not only of the individuals seeking services, but also of the individuals providing services. In our recent survey of Indiana pharmacists in 2016, we listed a panel of different types of individuals, like family members of someone who injects opioids, who would come in and ask for naloxone, and less than half of pharmacists responded that they were comfortable dispensing to the full panel of individuals we listed. And so it's really a two-sided thing. It's increasing comfort and understanding of addiction on the provider level, as well as simultaneously addressing the perception that asking for something like naloxone or seeking help for addictive behavior is in any way shameful or anything other than a medical necessity.
Justin, your thoughts. How do we deal with the stigma?
It's difficult, and I think that the doctor described a lot of it, and it's what we continue to try to do. Doing this show is helpful, you know, for people to hear and for us to continue to share the information and the stories and help families and caregivers and loved ones understand they're not alone, that there is help out there. We have done some training with some pharmacies, helping the pharmacist understand how to have that conversation if the individual is, in fact, in the store purchasing syringes for their grandmother, to still be able to open up the dialogue about naloxone at the time that that individual is there. The more we can understand the concept of harm reduction, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is going to get us a long way. And syringe exchange programs are part of harm reduction. And being able to meet that individual where they are, as opposed to asking them to come to us, because it's a shameful circumstance to be a drug user. It's not a choice they are making any longer. It's an unfortunate circumstance that they're trying to get out of.
So, Kelly, how? I mean, at some level, I'm going to reframe it a little bit, because obviously you deal with pharmacists mm-hmm. and are one
yeah.
yourself. How do you have those conversations with people when they come in? How do you structure something like that?
Well, in the case of
other than carefully, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, absolutely. In the case of the needle, the person coming and getting for their grandmother's diabetes, you know, it goes. You need to handle it delicately, but I think you also need to be very honest with the person and say, "I know you're here to get this, you know, for your mother and your grandmother and diabetes. But however, let me talk to you about naloxone. Do you know what it is? Do you know what it's used for? Do you know you can get it without having a prescription? Just start providing that information. And going along with the needle exchange, studies have shown just engagement with a healthcare professional can start those conversations. Yes, they come to your pharmacy and get these needles, but where, as a healthcare professional, can you intervene and say, let's talk about, you know, I've seen you in the last, you know, two times in the last week. Let's talk about what's going on. And again, pharmacists need to be comfortable with that. I mean, we don't get that kind of training in school. I think in the curriculum they are changing it, but it's opening that dialogue and letting that individual feel comfortable knowing that you're available to talk about it and you're not going to shy away from it.
Have you had those kinds of conversations?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I.
What's the toughest part about them?
Again, it's the shaming. The shaming, that acknowledging that I do have a problem, especially if they're not ready.
I mean, from your end.
From my end?
We know what it's like, because it's a conversation here where you get two people involved. And, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit here to give you a chance to collect your thoughts on this, because I really do want to hear your measured and weighed answer on it. But I would think, you know, you're going to be talking with someone that you at least have reason to believe is in considerable distress already. So the stakes are going to be high for that conversation. I mean, it's not too much to say that somebody's life is in the balance there, which means the conversation can be a little bit of a minefield and has got to create some anxiety on your part. So what's the toughest part of having that conversation for you?
Saying the wrong thing. Mm. Absolutely. Saying the wrong thing. And my background, I'm a clinical psychiatric pharmacist, so I know about the illness as well. And it's again, being comfortable enough to start the conversation. And I think for a lot of pharmacists out there that don't have my background, it's, am I going to say the wrong thing? Are they going to come back? Are they going to bring their friends? I know that that's a question, too. Do you turn your pharmacy into the naloxone pharmacy, where you have people that use drugs that are always there? But I always lean towards the more engagement you have, hopefully you can help someone talk about what's going on, how to seek treatment, where are the programs, things of that nature.
Dr. Agley, we've got about a minute and a half before we have to take our next break. And I wanted to ask, do we do enough training, not just for pharmacists, but for all the people who might interact with the folks who are in this sort of distress?
I think people are doing as much training as they've been taught they need. Mm-hmm. But the short answer is no, I think we probably need more. And that goes across all settings, not just pharmacies, but general academics, physicians, nurses. Addictions typically has been a very small portion of the curricula across all medical fields, and training to deal with something like this isn't something that is especially prevalent, and it's not something that comes naturally. And so, yes, definitely I recommend more training, studying how best to do it, how best to get it into a place like a pharmacy where the individuals working there, pharmacists, tend to be very well trusted by the community. Mm-hmm. How do we take the training that we've done for people who are already through school, for example, and infuse it into existing practice is kind of a secondary question. But that's kind of the 90-second version of saying yes.
Justin, we've got just a few seconds left on this. Do we need more training across the board on this issue?
Of course, we need more training across the board. Overdose Lifeline has some online self-directed learning specifically to help fill these gaps for employers.
Don't be shy. Go out and throw out the URL then.
It's www.overdose-lifeline.org, online self-directed learning.
Okay, and we will post that on our Facebook page too, so that people can track that afterwards. And I would invite you guys to continue the conversation on our Facebook page as well. We're talking about the availability of the overdose treatment drug naloxone today on No Limits. My guests are Dr. John Agley with the Indiana Prevention Resource Center, Justin Phillips of Overdose Lifeline, and Kelly Williams, clinical pharmacy specialist with Eskenazi Health. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the availability of the overdose treatment drug naloxone. It is part of our ongoing conversation in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media about, Indiana's and America's opioid epidemic. My guests are Dr. John Agley. He is with the Indiana Prevention Resource Center, Justin Phillips of Overdose Lifeline, and Kelly Williams, clinical pharmacy specialist with Eskenazi Health. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Or you can do what a listener named Douglas has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Douglas, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. I don't know what an opioid is. I've heard of an opiate, but I don't know what an opioid is. And could you give examples of what that is so that I could have an idea of what I'm thinking, what those are?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Douglas. Kelly.
Yeah.
So opioids, it used to be that it was separated out that like opioids came from the opium, the poppy seed plant. But now it's just all lumped together. So some opioids include your morphine, some brand names like Percocet, Vicodin, Norco, fentanyl. Those are all opioids. So that's what we're talking about, how naloxone reverses the effects of opioid overdose. Those are the medications we're referring to.
Okay. And how common? I know we've talked about the numbers of deaths. Do we have any numbers, Raleigh, on how many people here in the state are struggling with opioid addiction right now?
Do you know, Justin?
I don't know, because to be honest with you, sometimes it's so overwhelming. It just is more common than we realize. That 6 degrees of separation is really true. Everyone knows someone.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people misuse their prescription opioids for decades, and no one even is aware.
Mm-hmm.
They're functioning while they're misusing.
Can we talk a little bit, because I would think the stigma also makes it almost impossible for us to understand the scope of the problem we're dealing with, too. It's sort of like, I'm trying to think of a parallel, but, probably the Me Too movement now, because some people have started speaking up much more. It's empowered other people to speak up, and we suddenly realize, wow, there was a huge, huge, huge problem here. Not one, and in part, we didn't know how big it was because so much of it had been swept under the rug. Is that part of the challenge here? I'll start with Dr. Agley, but I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's definitely part of the problem. And to actually to answer your previous question, the State Department of Health actually does have information on drug overdose deaths involving opioids. And they have, for 2016, in Indiana, it was 785,
mm-hmm.
is what they've listed. And but in terms of your other question, I think it's something I tell my undergraduate students is that the issue of substance use, addiction, and misuse is so incredibly complex that anyone who says they have a complete answer either needs a Nobel Prize or needs to read some more. And so I don't propose to have a complete answer whatsoever. At the end of the day, I think that this is a relatively new thing, not just with opiates, but in general, because we are currently in this kind of nationwide transition from considering substance addiction to be a non-medical issue to considering it to be a medical issue. Simultaneously with that, there's the opioid epidemic. And that had predictors that are kind of separate from these other things that I'm talking about. So it's really the way we think about addiction in general and the way we have public discourse about it is changing broadly. And then that's also impacting more specifically what we're doing in terms of opioids. Although I would say stigma is certainly not the only, this is far from the only precipitating factor. Just, I hope that answers your question.
Well, it's a complicated question because it strikes me that at least with a lot of these problems, the persistent ones in our culture, you know, we struggle with the issue just of definition of how large it is. And it's hard to find a solution if you can't fully define the problem first. Justin.
Well, I think if we take into account that we lost 64,000 people in 2016, 2017, more lives lost than the Vietnam War, and we're not talking about it. That is an indication of our insistence to continue to deny this pretty serious public health crisis that is completely unprecedented. We have, for decades upon decades, you know, been under the abstinence-based only model of an anonymity in 12-step recovery programs for good reasons. But at the same time, if you're not talking about it, you don't ever develop a common bond with someone else. So I learned pretty quickly on after Aaron passed away that because I hadn't been talking about it loud enough, I felt it interfered with my getting Aaron the care I would have done had he been suffering from another chronic disease, right? Mm. I like to say sometimes that we never bring casseroles to families suffering from substance use disorder the way we do families suffering from cancer. Mm. And it's no different. Mm. So I had to start talking about it, and that's what I did. And when I started talking about it, more people came to me and said, that's my story too, similar to what you said before. And people feel empowered when they do get a voice, but someone has to start, and that's what we need to continue to do, to be willing to talk about it. Even if I know you're going to judge me, I'm still going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Kelly.
I was going to say, overdoses, it's indiscriminate. It crosses all barriers. I mean, if you look at celebrities, it seems like one every other month or something like that. And if you look back far enough, some of the celebrities we lost did have opioid overdose. And I applaud the media for telling the public this is what that person died from, because I think that does get the word out, too.
We've gotten sort of a question caution from a listener who didn't want to go on the air and say that we clarify that naloxone, like any drug, isn't exactly harmless. Basically, you don't have someone's allergies and histories. She was concerned that people listening would think there would be no repercussions if they used it on someone they didn't know. Kelly, I'll let you speak to that one.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, at the point of an overdose, I'm looking at this person who is in between life and death. I think that is the most important thing to remember. If they, you know, survive this overdose, we can talk about, you know, the allergy that was sustained or the injury that was sustained when given this medication. But if you go to the hospital, they're going to give you this medication if you're an opioid overdose.
We had another listener also who wanted us to talk a bit about the fact that, you know, this is just something that stops an overdose. It is not a cure for opioid addiction. That there is, you may have cheated death for a little while, but you are far from out of the woods. If that's the case, if you do have to administer naloxone, what are some responsible next steps? If you are, you know, a caring family member, caring friend, or someone, frankly, who has had to take naloxone because of an episode. Start with Dr. Agley on that one, but I want to hear everybody's thoughts.
Well, the first, I mean, if you're in an emergency setting as a non-emergency responder, either before or immediately after you administer naloxone, you should call 911 and get the first responders there as quickly as you can. But the individual who contacted you about naloxone not being a cure is exactly right. And that's kind of, it's not a stigma, but it's a misperception that, you know, if the overdose has been dealt with, then that person will not crave that substance anymore. Whereas there are a lot of things that can help the individual who overdosed that would include getting them, you know, coordinating with a treatment program, looking into peer recovery, looking into counseling. There's a whole spectrum of things that are shown to be beneficial. It's extremely, it's not impossible, but it is highly improbable that someone would overdose and be revived with naloxone and then not feel any cravings for that substance.
Justin, your thoughts.
Yeah, and it's very important to understand, first of all, going back to the first question, there's a law, a Good Samaritan law, that covers people acting in the best interest of someone in a medical emergency. So always keep that in mind. And this individual has potentially died for all intents and purposes. And naloxone never is the solution to the opioid public health crisis, but we cannot get someone into recovery if they're not alive. Mm. So we got to keep them alive to get them into recovery. And we may need to give them naloxone more than once to get them into recovery. But the important part is, yes, we got to get them alive and get them into recovery. 23 million people are in recovery, so it is possible, but there's a great deal of complex issues around opioid use disorder, the craving, but the withdrawal itself is something that keeps people away from recovery because they're so afraid of the pain that's involved in withdrawal. So they need a recovery support system behind them following the overdose. And I really like Kelly to talk about the great work that's done at Eskenazi as it relates to opioid response in the emergency room.
Well, and I'd also, but I'd like to get past how I haven't dealt, obviously, at this level, but I think, like we've pointed out, everyone knows somebody who's been addicted.
Yes.
At this stage. And one of the toughest things to deal with, if you're not trained, is just the denial. No.
Yes.
I don't have a problem. Nope. 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 I don't have a problem. You're the one who's got the problem. Mm-hmm. If you're, you know, da da da. So how do we get past that? I'll start with Kelly on that. But.
And we're talking about loved ones and yeah. or the person themselves. I think it has to start with, again, I know you're going to get tired of this, but open conversation, dialogue. This is what I'm seeing you do. This is, you know, I see that you have prescriptions that run out often, or you're always, you know, having some kind of pain issue where you have to go to the doctor. And it's having those open conversations with that loved one, with that family member, and getting past that denial. As I tell a lot of my pharmacists and people that I talk to when I do the training, is you got to remove yourself out of the equation. You have to go to it as a form of health care. We're in health care for a reason. You're here to take care of them. You want them to live. What can you do? What can you say to help them?
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you want to answer? I know Justin wanted you to talk about the stuff.
Talk about
you,
Project Point. Yeah. So when they come to Eskenazi and opioid overdose, all of our patients that leave the ER, they leave with a naloxone kit. And along those lines, they then set them up with an appointment to see someone next day or a day or two later immediately so they can get into treatment. Because when you do give naloxone, you put someone in an immediate withdrawal. So they're going to have those cravings. It feels like the flu, and then there's the I have to have it to, because you just don't feel well.
I can see we've got a bunch of questions teed
wow.
up and all of that, and we're getting toward the end of our time, so I'm going to ask everyone to please be quick. Emily, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi. Certainly. What's on your mind?
I'm sorry. What was that?
What's on your mind?
Oh, sorry.
Not a problem.
So I'm a recovering heroin addict myself, and actually now I'm working in the field of social work, and I just had a question. We had a presentation from some student interns at an agency I worked for previously a couple of years ago that were discussing, you know, liabilities and availability of naloxone, and they indicated, my understanding at least, was that there had been legislation passed to free us of any liabilities if we acted with good intent to try to reverse an overdose with naloxone. But when they were presenting this, the former director of the agency we worked for at the time, I think had a mini panic attack and just kind of tried to nix that conversation immediately, thinking that we were going to go carry naloxone and perhaps administer to our clients. And so my question is, does anybody know, you know, is that accurate that we do get are free from those liabilities based on whatever legislation they were discussing? And also, would we be considered a private agent if we were also still with a client at that time?
Thanks very much for the question. Sounds like it's one that has some serious application here. Justin.
I think because the law protects for anyone to have naloxone, you could be an employee of the agency and the agency does not choose to allow you to have that, but as an individual citizen, you are allowed under the law to have that. And the Good Samaritan portion of the law does protect you from any liability.
I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. Go ahead, Dr. Agley.
Oh, I was just going to say that there's a great resource that's at opt-in, all one word, optin.in.gov, and there is a toolkit for the statewide standing order, and it has exactly what you need to do by the Indiana code to indemnify yourself from various things. It's a great comprehensive document regarding those legal questions.
I'm going to go to a Facebook question or comment from a listener named Justin, not the one who's on the air here with us, who says, one important thing I have not heard is the short-term effects of naloxone, Narcan. It only has a lasting effect of 30 to 90 minutes. Someone that uses it should always call emergency services because they were able to make someone to wake someone up doesn't mean that when that time frame runs out, they're going to be back out of an overdose.
So we need to preface it by saying this is temporary reversal.
It buys you breathing space,
basically. And that's why you have to call 911 or get emergency help, because in pharmacy we say if it works fast, it leaves fast. So it does work within 3 to 5 minutes, but it's also going to leave the body depending on what dose they took, how much they took, what they took. If it's a long-acting medication, it's still in the body a lot longer.
And the nasal spray, I understand, acts a little quicker, right?
The injectable form acts like 1 minute faster than the nasal spray, which is another minute. So about 3 to 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And is that 30 to 90 minute window accurate, or is it?
Yeah, it's about accurate, but it depends again on what the individual used.
I think it's important because we were talking about the law and the liability. The law requires that you call 911.
You have to.
You are required by law to do that. And we want medical intervention because, as Kelly mentioned, naloxone wears off quicker than the opioid that's still in the system. So there is large potential for re-overdose.
Okay. Sadly, I think that's going to have to be the last word because we're coming up on time. But I would like to invite my guest, Dr. John Agley with the Indiana Prevention Resource Center, Justin Phillips of Overdose Lifeline, and Kelly Williams, clinical pharmacy specialist with Eskenazi Health, to continue the conversation on our Facebook page, take questions there, maybe provide some extra information. I also would like to thank our listeners for asking some very thoughtful and pertinent questions on this very important subject. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neil Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.